Well met, and welcome to Episode 8, the Bill/Shakespeare Project podcast for August 16th, 2009. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Greetings, this is Bill Walthall, and this week I want to tie up the concept of tragedy and try to wrap it up in a tidy little bow. So let's go back in time. Way back. Not all the way back to our old friend Aristotle, at least not yet, but back to the first century AD. Seneca the Younger was a Roman playwright, as well as a politician and philosopher. Some of his plays reworked stories from earlier Greek writers like Sophocles, but in his hands the plays had a greater focus on the terrible deeds that precipitate the tragic hero's fall. Sometimes witches and ghosts were employed to bring about actions or reactions by the characters, often prompting them to revenge. Now, his works had been lost to history until the mid-16th century, when his manuscripts were uncovered. This discovery led to a resurgence of the tragedy as a popular genre in plays, and influenced many Elizabethan playwrights. A notable example is Thomas Kyd, who in the late 1850s wrote a play called The Spanish Tragedy, which was filled with revenge and death, plus a ghost and a play-within-a-play elements not used here, but which would be employed later by Shakespeare in a little play we like to call Hamlet. Now, The Spanish Tragedy became one of the biggest hits of the day. And what's a young playwright like Shakespeare to do but to go with the prevailing trend? Remember, Francis Ford Coppola directed Dementia 13 before The Godfather, and James Cameron, Piranha Part 2, The Spawning, and isn't that a great title, before The Terminator. Think of it as a bold land grab for attention, a way for a young playwright to show his stuff, work in a genre that could be more likely to give him a hit, and to play with the conventions of the genre. Mission accomplished. So, this is Shakespeare's first tragedy, a play in which, according to our old friend Aristotle, and here's where we take that further trip back, our tragic hero is subjected to a reversal in fortune. Almost always, from good to bad, this reversal is supposed to create fear and pity in the audience, finally resulting in a catharsis, a release of emotion, and emotional cleansing. Now, according to Aristotle, this reversal of fortune is caused by the central character's hamartia. Now, many have incorrectly translated this as tragic flaw, as if it was some kind of character flaw or personality defect that causes the downfall. But technically, this is incorrect. Hamartia is an error in judgment. It comes from hamartianin, which was the situation of an archer missing his target. So really, it's more like the character is trying to achieve his goal, but a mistake leads to his downfall. Now, Aristotle also posits that the tragic hero should achieve some sort of anagnorisis, or a recognition or revelation about his situation and his position in the world or universe, or sometimes just between him and his antagonist. Now let's look at Titus Andronicus, starting with that last one, and move backwards. Does Titus achieve anagnorisis? Does he have a true recognition or revelation? Now while he does learn that Chiron and Demetrius are his daughter's rapists, he is clueless as to the depths of Tamora's betrayal of him, her condoning of the rape and mutilation of Lavinia. The Goth queen actually wants her killed, but the boys fail to follow through on this. And he certainly dies with no knowledge of Aaron's manipulation of events and people throughout the play. He never comes to any basic universal truth as, say, Lear and Romeo do. He just goes inextricably, inalterably, towards his demise. Now, let's take a look at the moment of Titus's hamartia, his error in judgment. When Titus arrives on the scene, which we had learned some 50 lines earlier was because the Senate had called him home to be the third candidate for emperor against the late emperor's two sons, Saturninus and Bassianus, his first action is to call for Rome to reward his surviving sons with love, and for the rites and burial of his sons killed in battle against the Goths, so that they can sleep in peace, being slain in our country's wars. Now Lucius, Titus's son, calls for a Gothic sacrifice to satisfy the ghosts of the dead, and Titus gives him Alarbus, Tamora's eldest son. Tamora pleads, "Stay, Roman brethren, gracious conqueror, victorious Titus, rue the tears I shed, a mother's tears in passion for her son. And if thy sons were ever dear to thee, O think my son to be as dear to me. Sufficeth not that we are brought to Rome, to beautify thy triumphs and return captive to thee and thy Roman yoke? But must my sons be slaughtered in the streets for valiant doings in their country's cause? Oh, if to fight for king and commonweal were piety in thine, it is in these. Andronicus, stain not thy tomb with blood. Wilt thou draw near the nature of the gods? Draw near them, then, in being merciful. Sweet mercy is nobility's true badge. Thrice noble Titus, spare my firstborn son. Her speech is masterful. It never feels false or manipulative. Sure, it's emotional, but it should be. More importantly, however, is that the speech is well-developed and beautifully constructed. She addresses Titus as a kind of kindred spirit, a warrior, though an enemy, a Roman brethren. And if that seems too presumptuous, she immediately backs off to show that she knows her place, one below the gracious conqueror, victorious Titus. She then begins her appeal to him in earnest. First, as a parent, Titus had just called for his son's burial, for his surviving sons to be shown love from Rome. Now she speaks as a mother, and Shakespeare works the meter and rhyme to make her argument all the more effective. And if thy sons were ever dear to thee, O think my son to be as dear to me. The two lines, second foot spondees, stress the thy and my, linking Titus and Tamora. And if that weren't enough, the lines rhyme thee to me, again cementing the parental bond. Now, very rarely does Shakespeare use rhyme in this play. It's not like the Comedy of Errors, where he seems to use it in every scene. It's very specific, his use in this play. So this rhyme here is of some importance. Next, she appeals to him as a martial leader, a soldier that respects the valiant doings in their country's cause on the battlefield. She asks if it is not enough for her and her sons to be paraded through the streets of Rome as slaves and captives, but now to be sacrificed too? If Titus can find piety in his own sons fighting for their country, then it should be the same for her sons. Finally, she appeals to Titus as a man, but as a man greater than most, one that can draw near the nature of the gods in being merciful. Father, soldier, godlike man, three appeals lead to one conclusion. Thrice noble Titus, spare my firstborn son. Again, Shakespeare allows Tamora to hammer home her point with two spondee feet that bookend the line. The first, like a concluding paragraph to the essay recounting the three points she has made, thrice noble. The second, accenting born, the giving of life, an act that Titus, and only Titus, can now do at this moment. Now anyone would be moved, if not to call off the sacrifice altogether, then at least to choose another martyr. Aaron, please, please, can it be Aaron? No, he is but a slave and not a great enough sacrifice. Well, anyone would be moved except for Titus. And Titus sends Alarbus to his doom. This decision sets forth an entire string of revenges and counter-revenges, which reverses Titus's fortune. He enters the play a powerful general and a cited candidate for emperor, only to become by the end a powerless outcast and possibly even deranged civilian. So, reversal of fortune, check. Hamartia, check. Anagnorisis, not so much. Maybe that's Titus's tragedy. So Titus's hamartia, or error in judgment, is his refusal to spare the life of Tamora's eldest son, Alarbus. Now that's the what. What about the why? Why does he make this decision? And why does he make the decisions that further his reversal of fortune? Well, let's go back to that whole piety idea. Titus is seen as the pious leader. He's been given that title of pious, which for the Romans meant not only pious, but also dutiful and patriotic. And he certainly has those qualities in spades. First, piety. The Oxford English Dictionary defines piety as both a devotion to religious observances and a faithfulness to duties naturally owed parents and relatives. And he does have a devotion to religious observance, as he allows for Alarbus to be executed because his living sons have religiously asked for a sacrifice for their brethren slain. Here, the religion is not so much his own, as he doesn't seem to be too religious himself, but those of his country, as Lucius says, our Roman rites. The faithfulness to the duties naturally owed to parents and relatives also applies here, because he allows all of this to happen for his sons. But what's even more interesting is that piety has another meaning as well, one that is older than the others, but was still in use during Shakespeare's day. And that definition is pity. Even if the argument can be made for Titus's piety, none can be made for his pity. And it's interesting still that the play's final words are, "Let birds on her take pity." In this play, there is simply no human pity. And if there is no pity, can there be piety? My opinion is that Shakespeare would probably answer that with a resounding no siree bub. Okay, anyway, next on the list is Dutiful. Titus is a soldier, a general, one who is sworn to defend Rome and its emperor. After he secures the imperial seat for Saturninus, he owes the new emperor his fealty. When Bassianus, the brother of the emperor and the beloved of Lavinia, attempts to take his secretly, but the emperor is publicly betrothed away, Titus immediately calls for the emperor's guard and tells Saturninus that he himself will soon bring her back. He is driven by a duty so ingrained that when his son Mutius stands in Titus's way, Titus kills Mutius, slays his own son. Duty to his emperor outweighs familial piety. Next on the list is patriotic. Above family, and even above the emperor, is Rome itself. When his sons and brother attempt to have the slain Mutius enshrined in the Andronicus tomb, Titus refuses, saying, "Here none but soldiers and Rome's servitors repose in fame, none basely slain in brawls." Of course, it's ironic that Titus himself was involved in such a brawl and did the slaying himself. That seems to slip the old general's mind. When it is Titus's time to die, he says he is sure that Rome and the righteous heavens will be his judge. Note that Rome comes even before heaven. These three qualities, piety, duty, and patriotism, are all positive, but pushed to their extreme lead Titus to make some poor decisions, and they beg the question, what kind of emperor would Titus have made? Well, let's take a look at the Rome to which Titus returns. The old unnamed emperor is dead. The two sons are presenting their respective cases to the tribunes. Saturninus proclaims his rights as the elder brother with arms and swords. Bassianus states that his loyalties are to virtue consecrate, to justice continence, and nobility. And he calls for an open, free election. The tribunes, it seems, have other plans. They have called home Titus from the Goth War to be a part of this electoral process. In other words, they have no confidence in either son. But like all plans, this one hits a snag. Titus doesn't want to be a candidate for emperor, and he states his claim simply. He says that he's an old man. He's at least 50 years old, assuming that he first went to war at no younger an age than 10, so more likely he's closer to 60. He is a shaken and feeble old man. He feels that he is too old for the role of emperor. If he takes the role today, tomorrow they will have to go through all this again when he's dead, he says. He has served Rome, and while he wants to be honored for his service, he does not want to be emperor. He ends his speech with an implicit approval of either of the two sons. He notes that the last emperor was an upright leader. Marcus, his brother, tries to convince Titus one last time, telling him that the imperial seat is his for the asking. Saturninus takes offense at this. Titus attempts to calm Saturninus, and then a very interesting thing happens, one that is implicit in the meter of the line. Saturninus interrupts Titus just as Titus is about to say his name. Titus says, "Patience, Prince Saturninus." In the same poetic line, Saturninus says, "Romans do me right." Now, for the poetic line to work, Saturninus has to interrupt Titus early in the line, and this is corroborated by the text itself, as Lucius calls Saturninus an interrupter just two lines later. Saturninus continues his violent reaction, calling for his followers to draw their swords, spurring them on to war, telling them not to sheathe those swords until he is emperor. Lucius comes to his father's defense, but Titus takes over. In his two-line response, Titus speaks to Saturninus, offering to give over his support, his people's hearts, to Saturninus. Now, what's interesting here, in my view, is the opening of those two lines, the "content thee, prince" part. My take is that Titus is saying this to Lucius to calm down his own son before addressing Saturninus. The prince here being a show of respect for his own son, or a nice piece of foreshadowing by Shakespeare, or both. Lucius, as we will see throughout the course of the play, is in often need of calming. Titus is as good as his word to Saturninus. Titus asks the tribunes if they will support and vote for his choice, and they agree. Titus then gives his support to Saturninus, and this is a subtle speech. Titus throws his support behind Saturninus, but only because he is the eldest son. Again, Titus's piety leans towards tradition, familial hierarchy. So while he gives his support, he also intimates that he has some doubts. Titus can only hope that the new emperor's virtues will shine upon Rome. Does Titus make the best decision for Rome? In hindsight, of course not. But Titus is an old, and probably not too old to rule, but old, and more importantly, tired, man. He doesn't want to fight anymore. He has sheathed his sword. To go against Saturninus would mean to go to war himself, or to join forces with Bassianus to war against the elder son. Either descends Rome into a bloody civil war. Titus's decision avoids that. Titus decides, he is the great decider, and once he makes his decision, he doesn't go back. Just ask Tamara. He's stubborn, traditional, unbending. And it is these personality traits rather than his piety, duty, and patriotism that lead him to his fateful decisions. Because he cannot, or will not, change his mind, his fate is set, Rome's fate is set, and the rest of the play is just the relentless, horrific march towards the inevitable. Would Titus have made a good emperor? Maybe, but probably not. Certainly Saturninus, a choice made by heredity and tradition, was a disaster as emperor. Lucius, at the end of the play, also achieves the imperial seat by heredity, as he's Titus's son, and tradition, as he's the last man standing. And he begins his rule with some incredibly cruel decisions, Aaron's tortured death, and Tamara's post-mortem non-burial. So what does that leave us with? Ah, yes, Bassianus's adherence to virtue consecrate, to justice, continence, and nobility. He felt confident that these concepts would shine in a free election, but he, and Rome, and we as an audience never got a chance to see that happen. Is Shakespeare saying something here? Did he share Bassianus' democratic view? I don't know, but it is an interesting question. That was a long one. But before we leave for the week, it's time to launch a new contest. So, okay, pretend you're a director and you're about to mount a production of Titus Andronicus, or it could be a movie version. Who would be in your dream cast? And why? Now, why, worthy listeners, should you do this? Why, for a free Bill/Shakespeare Project t-shirt to the best/most original/most well-reasoned casting director. That's why. You can enter by commenting to this blog entry. Contest entries are due before 12 noon Pacific time on Thursday, August 27th. I'll announce the winner in the last podcast of the month on Sunday, August 30th. Good luck. You've been listening to the Bill/Shakespeare Project podcast for August 16th. 2009. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com, and we shall see thee anon.